Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium. It's good to be back on the air with you guys. It's been a long while, been a bit of a break. This is Rich Tate, of course, filling in for Mike Norris, who, as I understand it, has a long way to go, but he's come a long way. Bobby, you want to elaborate on that for us a bit?
Michael is eating solid food. He has started his physical therapy on a very, very low end of the physical therapy range. He is, they've tried to get him up walking, but Mike's very, very weak. His kidneys, he's been in the bed 7 weeks. His kidneys still aren't functioning, so he's still having to take dialysis, but he's getting better. He's getting more alert. He's more, able to carry on conversations with you and kind of comprehend what's going on around him a little bit better. So he's getting better. It's a long road to recovery, and it's going to be a very slow process. But he, as I tell people, he's on the road, and that's the main thing. I think he's amazed the doctors, and I think he's going to be okay. It's just going to take a while.
All right. And, of course, I'm going to let you, I don't know, obviously, you had a extremely close loss to you, and I just want you to know I love Debbie to death. She was just the greatest. I don't know. You walk in a room, she'd light it up.
Yeah, it's.
Just want you to know we're here.
I appreciate it. I wanted to thank everybody for the calls and the cards and the emails and if I didn't respond to you, please forgive me. I was overwhelmed with the. With the outpouring of support that I received. Just in case anybody didn't know, Debbie went home to be with the Lord on the 14th day of December. We buried her 2 weeks ago today. It's been the longest 2 weeks of my life, I think. It's very lonely around here most of the time now, and when I think about it, but we're going to be okay. And because of my faith and her faith, I didn't lose her. I know where she's at. And I'm gonna be okay. It's just gonna take some time. I've got a great support group around me, and I got folks that that care about me, and we're gonna be okay. But it's gonna be difficult. But again, thanks to everybody. I couldn't believe the people that showed up at her visitation. That just out of the blue, I wasn't expecting them, but they showed up, and it's been good. So anyway, we'll do the best we can. She told me if this ever happened, I had to live and keep going. So that's what we're trying to do.
All right. Did she also tell you to return my Christmas card? Because yours came right back to me.
No.
I figured you didn't want my Christmas card, man.
No, I didn't.
We'll talk about that off there. It showed up in the mailbox today. That's all right.
Well, if you put a big check in it or something, it probably didn't pay enough postage.
I had to give all my money to Charlie Smith.
I understand.
Jerry, obviously, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year to you as well, sir.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Holidays go well for you?
Yeah, went good. I just thought about Bobby the whole time, and, that's a tough thing to bear, but.
Hope you never go through it, my boy. I'm sorry I didn't speak to you. I didn't even realize you was there. I'm sorry.
That's all right. That's all right. How was your Christmas and New Year's, Mike? I mean, Rich.
George, Fred, whatever your name is.
Yeah, Frank, whatever.
Yeah. All right. No wonder my car
came. I'm so used to saying Michael.
All right. I got it. I know my role now. No.
Stop.
Christmas went well here. Went pretty well here. All right. Want to bring up a line now. I believe, I don't recognize this number, but he's been on with us since right before we went on the air. It doesn't look like the number I know him by, but Jay West was going to join us this evening. Let's see if this is him. Jay, you on the line? And apparently that's not Jay. All right, let's check this one out. Jay, you on the line?
Hello there. Is this the Colorado dispensary?
Yeah.
I understand you have some specials going.
Oh Lord. Yeah, it is 2014 now, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It not in Georgia, but in some parts of the country.
That is Obamacare.
Yes, and just getting ready for the, what I understand, the 38 degree high we're going to have here tomorrow. So.
Oh jeez.
Yeah.
Glad to be in the house.
How were your holidays, Jay?
They were sick. I've and that's not using a colloquialism, but about 2 weeks ago, I don't know what was going on, but my wife and I both came down with something here that's going around, and we're recuperating, but that's been a slow process. And so anyway, we're working on that. But otherwise, good. Speaking of Christmas cards, I sent you one. It came back, and then I sent it to you again. My wife had put the wrong address on it, so I don't know if you finally got it or not. But
We did, and I appreciate it, sir.
Well, that's okay. Bobby, how are you?
I'm doing well. Doing well.
Good to hear from you.
I have my moments, but I'm doing well.
Well, that's the whole deal. You got to keep on having the moments, you know.
Yeah.
And Jerry, how are you?
I'm great, guy. How are you?
All right. So here we are.
All right. I didn't really have any grand plans for tonight. I just wanted to get us all back on the air together and see where we could go. Don't know if anybody's noticed, but I do want to mention off the top of the air, get a little plug in here for GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, that we started doing some old school features at the website. Started that yesterday. We've so far posted four. It's basically a look back at just some various events in history, and we're going to at least try to have at least one a day, and hope everybody enjoys those. I thought it might be interesting to kind of hop over to the Kayfabe Memories message board. I hadn't visited there in a long time, and I kind of resurfaced over there in the last month, and I thought it might be interesting just to run down maybe just randomly. I'll go through the topics, and if there's a question posed, I'll throw it out there to you guys and answer it. Well, how about that?
Okay.
All right. Well, I don't know the names here. These guys use screen names. But anyway, were there plans for some of these we, of course, I'm sure have hashed over many times. I know I have. I know Bobby has, especially at the interview I did with him years ago. But we'll just do them anyway, see where we go. Were there any plans for Georgia Championship Wrestling to expand past Ohio, Tennessee, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania while they debuted over the country through Superstation WTVS in 1980? Bobby, I believe that one would be suited for you at that time frame.
Just to restate it in case somebody don't know, the way we decided to go to Columbus, Ohio was, if people remember watching Georgia Championship Wrestling, Bill Watts came up with an idea. He had Harley Race and Wrestling 2 in the main event, either to Auditorium or the Omni, I don't remember which. And it was one of those deals where 2 almost beat the champion and Harley saved it by being disqualified or something. So they proclaimed 2 the champion of champions. Gave him this big cup, which was totally against the NWA rules and bylaws, because it said you could not have a championship that surpassed the World Heavyweight Championship, and that's what Watts came off as this champion of champion. He beat the NWA champion, and this made 2 the whatever. So somehow or another, this turned into a mail-in where we had people write in for something, and I don't remember exactly how it was set up, but the mailman would back up to the arena and unload bags of mail. I mean, we're not talking 1,500 letters. We're talking thousands of letters that he would unload, and this went on for 2 weeks. And they paid Randy, my friend, to open the bags of mail, and he did not open the first letter. All he did was look at the postmarks. That is how he, that's how we determined that he was, the majority of the letters came from Columbus, Ohio, in that area. That's how we decided to run Columbus, Ohio. Barnett made a deal with the sheik, paid him some money to run the town because the sheik wasn't running it, and we ran the Ohio Center, which was a brand new facility there. We went in there the opening weekend that facility opened up. On Saturday night, they had Conway Twitty and Jerry Lee Lewis, and they drew half a house. And we went in on Sunday night and sold out the building in less than 13 minutes. And when they put the tickets on sale, 15 minutes later, it was over. There was no tickets to be had. And that's how we went up there. We expanded into Michigan and West Virginia because the sheik screwed us on some deals that we were trying to work with him, and he did us like he did everybody else in the wrestling business. And, you know, God loved these people that thought he was a saint. He was not a saint to me or the business that we did with him. And when that happened, Barnett decided, you know, hey, if that's the way he's going to do, we're going to run. And that's how we went into Michigan. And we did a little bit in the corner of Pennsylvania, nothing to offend Vince Sr. at the time. And the Tennessee thing was we basically ran Chattanooga because we bought it from Gulas. And then, of course, when he bought the Knoxville territory from Fuller, we went into there. But that was pretty much it. There wasn't any plans to, you know, I even suggested back then we get a bus and go on a national tour because it was strong enough to do it, but Barnett had no plans. He was not going to – he was NWA old school, and he was not going to step on anybody's toes. So well, what we did was pretty much it.
All right. Go ahead.
I was just going to say this was obviously, as Bobby was mentioning, the territories were still strong, so it would have been difficult to expand much more without causing some problems, I would think. But, you know, business is business. I have heard that all my life, and I'm sure there would have been a way to work it out if, you know, if some town would have really looked great. But, you can only stretch your talent so far, and that was one of the things that happened with that expansion. Some of those big cities were working so well that it was hurting some of the towns in Georgia because you didn't have the talent available.
Yeah, we would send 10, 12, 14 guys and a referee up north, and just the logistics of doing this, you know, you couldn't depend on people up there to supply the ring because they could be bought off by somebody and they wouldn't show up. So we wound up having to send a ring truck up there. We had to send a crew up there to take care of that. We had to there was the cost of getting the guys there. We furnished rental cars. It was a lot that went into doing those tours, and they were financially viable. They were, you know, they wouldn't have done it if they hadn't. But as Jerry can tell you, back in that time frame we're talking about, these promoters were in business to make money, but they were also fiercely loyal to each other. I mean, they would not. I mean, you didn't step on another guy's toes. And they just wouldn't do it. It was the way they were brought up. It was the way they were taught in this business, and it just wasn't going to happen. And Barnett was the same way. He was not going to run somebody else's town. Even though the law says you couldn't do that, there were boundaries you didn't cross.
And it was another way to protect the business.
Yes.
All right. Another question. It sort of gets answered, but I'm going to throw this out there. Somebody's wanting to know, they were wrong about what they were asking. They suggested that the little bit of footage that they had on the 1980 video they saw for a segment that was done on Tommy Rich, an It's Your Life kind of thing, showed some footage of him teaming with Martel from 78, and the guy wanted to know if that was the oldest footage of GCW. And, of course, basically that gets shot down through the thread here. Somebody actually points out the Bill Watts Mr. Wrestling match from 1973 that we got up on YouTube. I know about some footage that Chuck Thornton taped back in the mid to late 60s, but it was all 8 millimeter, hard to see, no audio. But as far as oldest footage, maybe from studio, do you guys know of any footage older than that Bill Watts, Tim Woods match that exists?
Well, there was a, if you remember the Live Atlanta Wrestling Show, it always started with a Sousa March, and this is, you know, pre-GCW, when it was on Channel 11. And there was a film clip from the auditorium that had Buddy Fuller and Ray Gunkel against, I can't remember who, but that footage was taken from the auditorium and on film, obviously, and it was around in the 60s. I don't know who took it and what else they used it for, but it was actually a film shot that they opened the show with.
And, Jerry, did I hear you about to chime in there, too?
No, I said I wouldn't know either. I would have no idea.
Okay. Bobby, you got a guess on any?
I don't know what happened to all that stuff. You know, like I say, you got to. I mean, we recycle those tapes. There may be
right.
Something out there. Who knows? I mean, there was a room full. When I left the office in December of '83, I think it was December of '83. I can't remember what it was. I think
82.
It was '82. December of '82. When I left the office, there was a room full of videotapes, 3/4-inch tapes, and 16-millimeter movie film that had been shot over the years. And I had borrowed a movie camera, and I had spent 3 weeks going through and looking at this stuff that nobody had looked at in years and labeling it all. We had a closet there at the office, and it was full of that stuff. What happened to it, I have no idea. I doubt very seriously if it got thrown away. But who got it, where it went, I don't know. Ole has told Charlie that there's some stuff in his attic up there at his house up on the lake, and he's told Charlie whenever he can get back up there that Charlie can have whatever's up there. There may be some of that stuff in his attic. Don't know what kind of shape it'd be in, and I'm not saying it is there, but it could be.
All right, I'm calling Charlie, and we're making a road trip.
Well, you got to wait till Ole gets up there. But there ain't no telling what's up there, you know. But all of it, I know it was there. There was a piece of tape I'd give my eye teeth for. They did a deal, and I don't know if Jerry was on the card or not, but they did a deal when they were having. Were you here when they were doing the Cadillac tournament in 73?
Oh, was it that early?
No, I wasn't here, Bobby.
They did a Cadillac tournament in 1973 that Bobby Shane won, and eventually the next week lost it to Bob Armstrong, and it's that red Cadillac Bob drove for 100 years. There is a footage of the final match between Bob Armstrong and Bobby Duncombe.
Oh, really?
And Bobby Duncombe, part of the deal was to get the price of the car down. Armstrong agreed to do a hard way. And Duncombe hit him about 3 times. He almost knocked him out. And finally, the fourth time he hit him. Was you there?
Yeah,
I saw the match.
The fourth time he hit him, he opened him up. I have never seen so much blood in my life. They could not use it on TV. It was so much blood that they were slipping in the ring. And that piece of film was there. But
that,
I don't know what happened to it. Do what?
That was from the that whole Cadillac tournament thing and the match you're talking about. That all took place in May and June of 73. Because that was built around the first 3 Omni cards.
Yep, there you go.
I think they ran 3 weeks. And
yep.
So that would have been and I got to go back even to at least of what I've seen. I mentioned the Watts Tim Woods match, but that was in July of 73. I got to go back and say now that it was the May from the actual debut at the Omni on May 18th, 73, there's a match out on YouTube that had been shown on Championship Wrestling from Florida. It's got Gordon Soley there at that studio, I guess in Tampa, or St. Pete, where that was. I think, what was it, Tampa?
Tampa.
Anyway.
Tampa. 106 North Albany.
Yeah, he introduces the match, and he talks about it being the debut at the Omni, and it's the Grahams and the Medics. And he's doing play-by-play over the tape. So that was May 1873. I got to figure that's the same footage grouping you're talking about. Man, I'd love to know where that is.
Well, like I say, I don't know what happened to it. I have no clue what happened to it, but there was a closet full of that stuff.
Now, there's been an urban legend out on the internet for a long time. Of course, you know, surprise, surprise, that only somewhere along the way somebody decided that they heard, and it got carried around that Ole actually went and threw out a bunch of footage. Cleaning out his garage or some stuff. Now, I asked Ole about that one day. I asked him if he knew anything about that. He said he had no clue what they were talking about. But
Ole's
I don't see Ole
too,
being,
too cute
Ole
to have
it.
Thrown anything away like that.
Exactly. It doesn't sound like him at all.
No.
Well, Gordon's son shot a lot of footage over the years at the Omni particularly. Bobby, did he have to turn all of that footage over to the office?
It was in that closet. It was in that closet. That was our camera, our film. We would take it. He would shoot it on Friday night. I would take it, or Randy would take it, or we'd both take it over to a place off of Faulkner Road there off of Cheshire Bridge. They would develop it. We would pay them extra money to develop it overnight where we would have it for TV the next morning. And all of that film, when we were through using it, it was put into that. It was labeled and put into that closet. So, like I say, who knows what was there.
Well, he shot a lot of stuff, a lot of great stuff.
You know the. I guess it's on YouTube. I've seen it around. The footage of Dusty winning the title the first time in Atlanta.
Right.
When he beat Harley. If you go back and watch that, that's footage that Eric Soley shot with a 16mm camera. If you watch the match, he was shooting from the mezzanine upstairs, and the key for him to come to the ring was when Harley came off the top rope, and when he came off the top rope, he quit shooting and he came down to the ring and finished filming it at the bottom, you know, by the ring. Mm-hmm. So it was that's part of that as well. But there was a closet full of stuff. I'm telling you, it would fill up a pickup truck.
Rich, do you remember when Hulk Hogan first came in, the dates when he came in using the name Sterling Golden before he became Hulk Hogan?
Yeah, that would have been late summer and fall of 79.
Okay. Well, that I know on YouTube that's, you know, as far as something seeing him pre-Hulk Hogan, that one of his matches that he had on TV is on YouTube, and my interest in it was me, you know, Googling myself, so to speak, and introing that match. But whatever year that was, I know that that match exists from the TV show on YouTube.
Right. All right. Let's get into some questions about some of the guys that passed through Georgia here. Just curious if anyone has any recollections of Stasiak's run in Georgia during 1976. I noticed a stretch where he worked against Mr. Wrestling 2 often as well as Dick Slater, then later teamed with Slater as well. A one-month run as Macon heavyweight champ and an affiliation with Abdul the Butcher during the year are some main points. Anything of note you could add? Jerry, you were here in 76.
I was here, yeah.
Did you get to work with Stasiak?
Yeah, I remember Stan well. I remember him well. I was involved in tag matches when he was here, but I remember him well. Bobby, you wasn't was you with the office then?
Yeah.
Yeah, you remember Stan.
I was still refereeing. in 76. They had a I give you a funny story about Stan. Stan was a funny guy. He is the one guy that cracked me up in the ring more than, I mean, he cracked me up so bad I had to go sit down on a turnbuckle. I was crying so hard laughing. But the thing I guess I remember most about him, or the funniest thing, he won the Georgia heavyweight title on a Friday night in Atlanta. He beat Wrestling 2 for the title. And that Tuesday night, or I guess it was a Tuesday night, Fred ran Norman Park, Georgia. Did you ever make that little sweet spot, Jerry?
I don't even know where that is.
Yeah, I've never heard of that in my life.
Okay.
We worked a little old place there, a little old high school or something, and the semifinal match on the card was Stasiak against Leon Ogle. So I'm in the babyface dressing room, and Leon is giving me the finishes, and he gives me the first two matches, and then he says, go over and tell Stan that, he said, tell him to get his heat on me and said, make a comeback. He said, shoot me in for a backdrop. He said, I'll leapfrog him, and when he turns around, I'll small package him, 1, 2, 3. And I remember looking at him, and I said, Leon, let me get this straight now. You're going to beat the Georgia champion right in the middle of the ring. And he goes, yes. And I said, okay. And he said, one other thing. He said, tell Stan, if he don't mind, to get real low on that backdrop so I can make sure I can get over him. And I said, okay. So I went over to the other dressing room, and I relayed this information to him. And I'll never forget the look he gave me. And I said, I'm sorry. That's what he told me. And I said, by the way, he said, could you get real low on that backdrop where he can leapfrog you? We went out there, and they worked a match. And Stan, of course, he worked hard just like he always did, and they had a pretty good match. Well, they got ready to go into this thing, and when he shot Leon in for that backdrop, he almost tripped Leon because he dropped down on all fours.
No, he did not.
And he took 5 minutes to stand up. That's the slowest I ever seen anybody stand up in my life. And Leon was just standing there waiting. And when he turned around, he small packaged him, and I counted him out. But I just, I like Leon. Me and Leon got along fine. He was all right. But, buddy, I just, when he told me that night, it shocked me, and I know it shocked him. But that,
well, has anybody thought? Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say that around that 76 time when Stasiak was, pretty hot and working as a top-rung heel, I don't know what happened, but one night in Griffin, he ended up having to be babyface against whoever he was working with. It was another heel, and it didn't lead anywhere. It was just, I guess as it turned out, somebody didn't show up or who knows what. But at any rate, he worked babyface in that match, and it was really interesting how well the fans went for him. So that was something that nobody really saw anywhere else in the state, but it did happen that one night in Griffin.
Have some questions come up, too. Nothing really to throw in here, but it's about a guy that I really liked watching, Scott Irwin. Somebody's talking about his run here as Super Destroyer. Bobby, you were here at that time, and Jerry, I'd be interested to know you as far as being in the ring. Did you ever get to wrestle with him?
Yeah, he knocked me out in Macon.
You don't forget that, do you?
No, he did. He did with a belt. I was wrestling his brother, and he jumped up on the apron, and he hit me one of those tag belts and knocked me out.
Jeez.
You
didn't have no trouble selling it, did you?
No, sir. I went straight down.
We've all had those moments, and they're funny now. They're not funny when they happen, though.
No, it's not funny at all, though.
He was making sure you got low enough so he could leapfrog it.
Oh, geez.
Evidently.
Okay. What kind of guy was he? I got to tell you, man. The team with him and Bill Leedy as superstar and super destroyer. I loved watching that team as a kid. I couldn't get enough of those guys. Thought they were awesome. Would have loved to have seen it last a little longer. I think that I think it was maybe about a, I don't know, 12, maybe 18-month run. What can you guys tell us about Scott Irwin?
This is the only place I was ever around him, Rich. I never ran across him anywhere else.
I first met Scott when he came in here, would have been 74, 75, when he came in here. He just got started, and he was preliminary. You know, he come in here, and that's when I first met him. Nice guy. And then, of course, I was working in the office when him and Bill were doing the Super D and the Superstar thing. And then I got a chance in 85 when I was working for Ann, that last little run we had with Ann. He came in and worked as he had a motorcycle gimmick, and that's when that's when he told me he had the cancer, and you know, he was just trying to work as long as he could, and he did some shots here and did a few things, but nice guy, worked hard, and we lost him way too soon.
All right, let's see, let's go. Just for a second, let's go pay some bills and come back here in just a few minutes.
All righty.
Wrestling fans, Anarchy Wrestling television tapings are the second and fourth Saturdays of every month at 4236 Level Grove Road in Cornelia, Georgia. For more information on Anarchy Wrestling and on the shows to watch the television product and a whole lot more, go to anarchy-wrestling.net. That's Anarchy Wrestling, the second and fourth Saturdays of every month in Cornelia, Georgia.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.
Whether you're having an autograph session, personal appearance, or live event, we got just the person you need to contact for all of those needs. SBI Bookings is home of some of the best stars in the wrestling industry today. They provide you with the best talent this business has to offer, from Kevin Nash, Larry Zbysko, Scott Steiner, and many, many more. So who will you contact next time you're planning an event? The men of SBI Bookings. Check them out at sbibookings.com.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Solie? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at georgiawrestlinghistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at georgiawrestlinghistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out georgiawrestlinghistory.com.
Welcome back to Peach State Pandemonium. Rich Tate here, of course, with Bobby Simmons, Jerry Oates, and joined by Jay West as well tonight. Just running down some topics that showed up on the kayfabememories.com message board recently, or at least within the last couple of months or so. Just kind of throwing some names around, some events around. Jerry, I believe you worked for Ole a little bit on the Championship Wrestling from Georgia promotion after Vince had come down and done his thing here, and that was the startup, of course, I believe, Ole and Ralph Freed. What can you tell us about that promotion? That was just
well, kind of, you know. Go ahead, Rich.
I was just going to say, I mean, you know, there was some good talent there for a while, and then it just sort of petered out. You had the horrible time slot of showing up in the mornings and way too early in the morning on a weekend. And just at some point it just seemed like things were just sort of thrown together.
Yeah, it started off all right, you know, and, we there was a good crew in here, and, you know, it just we were just hoping that it would last, you know. Everybody had work, and it was working every night, and it just faded away, you know. I mean, you could almost see the handwriting on the wall, you know. But I enjoyed it. I was home, and I enjoyed it. I just wish it had lasted, but it didn't. It wasn't meant to be.
Yeah, I think by that time, it just seems like, I don't know, Atlanta fans just sort of tuned out. And I don't know if it was just bitterness, I guess, of seeing McMahon on just yet another channel on TV and no more Gordon on 17, even though he was on the other channel. I don't know if maybe it seems like word of mouth just didn't get around because the houses were down, even though the talent was still there at first. I don't know.
Well,
if
you remember, the fans clamored for, you know, wanting to see their guys back again, wanting to see Gordon Solie, and 17's, phone lines were red hot, and I think that probably helped Ole get the inertia to get the show, even though it was, as you said, on at a very early time. But I just think there was so much competition there, you know, with the WWF, and, you know, Bill Watts had been promoting, and you're right. There was just so much talent that Ole had, and how many times can you see the same main event?
Right. All right. Name that came up earlier, Hulk Hogan as Sterling Golden. Jay and Bobby, I know you guys were here when he was here. Talk about Hulk Hogan before Hulk Hogan.
Bobby, do you remember the signature that he had on his chest when he came in as Sterling Golden?
I don't remember much about him other than I was there when Ole fired him.
When he first came in, and, you know, I guess he'd been in Alabama before he came over here, and, just deciding he was going to be a star, but he had his chest hair shaved, and he said it was in the shape of an explosion. But some other people thought it was a different body part. And so, in fact, he was told very quickly after he was here to shave that thing off. And so he was put in his place pretty quick, Sterling Golden was.
Well, some things never change, and it never did with him. He didn't know a wrist lock from a wristwatch.
He was a guitar player.
Yeah,
that's what he was before he got in the wrestling business.
He thought that he thought because of his now he looked good, man.
He looked good. He did
until the bell rang, and there was nothing you could do with him. I mean, there's only so much you can disguise with smoke and mirrors, and I mean they had guys taking bumps and flying all over the ring, and you know, but one thing about fans in Georgia, they were educated to wrestling, and it didn't take them long to figure out if a guy could wrestle or not.
Right.
You know, if he could perform. And it took 2 weeks to realize, I mean, there was nothing you could do with the guy. There was nothing you could do with him. And, I mean, if you even look at the Hulk Hogan craze, he was in the right place at the right time with a very smart promoter that used what he had, and the majority of Hogan's stuff, you know, what got him over was not in the ring. It was everything surrounding him outside the ring. Because if you had based it on his matches, he wouldn't have drawn 15 cents.
Well, he had a pretty good mouth on him. You know, he could talk
yeah.
fairly well. But like you're saying about being in the right place at the right time out there working for Vern Gagne. And, with the gimmick of the name that he had, the Hulk, McMahon just, that deal just came along at just the absolute right time.
Yep. And, you know. Can't knock success. He made a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
But, what's he doing today and where's he at? And you know, it's just, everything you hear is on the negative side. So
right. He's in pretty bad shape, as I understand.
Yeah, that's what I hear. But that's, I don't know. There just wasn't nothing you could do with the guy. I mean, he could not go out there. You couldn't tell him to go out there, so we want you to have a 20-minute match with this guy. He couldn't do it. And as the heel, you know, most of the time, the heel led the match. Well, he didn't have a clue. So you couldn't do that, and it was just, it was what it was, but it lasted 2 weeks, I think.
Well, he was here for, it seems like about 6 weeks, maybe seven.
Was that long?
Well, it seemed even longer. Bobby, let me ask you, you said earlier that you were there when he was fired. I was kind of curious about that and how that went down because the way Ole explained that he says he called Vern and sent him up there, but if I'm not mistaken, he went to the WWF straight from here and then later on ended up in the AWA and then went back to the WWF for the big run.
I'm not sure where he went when he left here. Basically, what Ole told him was what we just talked about. Hey, we can't do nothing with you. You know, you're not getting over. People aren't buying it. And you know, there's nothing else we can do. I mean, that's pretty much what he told him. I mean, he wasn't ugly with him. He just told him. He said, there's nothing else we can do. And whether he called or got him booked or whatever, I don't know about that. But, you know, he was just straightforward. He didn't do nothing but tell him the truth. But you know, there's nothing else we can do with you.
How hands-on was Barnett in terms of personnel? I mean, did Ole put up with him maybe a little longer than he normally might have?
I don't think so. Barnett pretty well let – Jim pretty well let Ole handle all of the talent. You know,
okay.
I mean, he would – And, you know, Barnett sometimes would suggest, you know, would say, I'd like to bring this guy in or that guy in, or if they wanted to get a guy in here and there needed to be some politicking done between promoters or owners or whatever, you know, Barnett would get involved a little bit, but nothing, not a whole lot. He pretty well let Ole handle all of that.
Right. Hey, Jerry, did you ever work with Hogan in the ring?
Never have, no.
Okay. Another guy that was in here kind of at the same time and also legend is he got fired for missing a show and he's adamantly denied that he ever missed a show. But I got to wonder, to some degree, why they would have seemingly been pushing him. A couple weeks before he got fired, Bret Hart was on a cover of one of the Atlanta Ringsiders. Seems to me if they were working him out and pushing him out, they would have had him on the program literally about a week before he left. What do you guys know about that story?
I can't remember if he missed
nothing.
A shot or not. Honestly, they said he missed Augusta. I can't remember if he did or not. But when Bret Hart was here, Bret Hart was strictly preliminary. He wasn't being pushed. He was strictly first, second, third match.
Well, there were a lot of young guys like him that had that look, you know, that was being groomed for later on, and he was just with that look was just one of the pack, you know.
Right.
And another thing too about being on the program, Freddie did the programs, and Freddie would put on the cover of the program who would sell programs, and you got to remember, you know, he was very appealing to the young teeny bopper generation, and there was a bunch of those guys in here at that time, you know, and that could have some. That was, you know, Barnett didn't make those decisions. That was Freddie's doing.
Yeah, it worked. That was part of the business. But yeah, that's why Tommy Rich showed up on the cover so many times. It wasn't because of his abilities either. Not putting them down, but you know, you didn't get on the cover because you were the best worker in the office.
Another guy,
Charlie Smith, put those programs together for 100 years, and the program that sold the most copies when we were Gunkel Enterprises. If you go back and look at those old Gunkel programs, they always put a full page on the back was for an autograph of some some, you know, one of the wrestlers
right.
or somebody. This
yep.
is not made up. This is a fact. The week that the most programs were sold, guess who was on the back of the program? Charlie
Smith.
Charlie Smith. Because Ann Gunkel fussed about him being on the program, but when she seen the program sales, she changed her tune.
Well, how many did Charlie buy?
Well, there ain't no telling. But what, you know, Charlie was, he would do that old school thing, you know, y'all don't tear that picture up of me. And, of course, you know, they'd tear it up and go buy another one and tear it up. So, you know, it was, I think for all the time we were in business, the record for selling the most programs of a particular issue was when he was on the back cover.
I still say he's the most autographed person in wrestling.
Maybe.
And he's always looking at the camera.
Yes, sir.
another guy that had a relatively short run in Georgia, and I was kind of always curious as to maybe circumstances around that, was Kevin Von Erich. He was in here, of course, in 81 that summer, teaming with Michael Hayes when they were feuding with Terry Gordy and Jimmy Snuka. And that elicited a chuckle from Bobby, so I'll let Bobby answer that one.
This was the first territory Kevin ever came to outside of home, okay? He came in here. Barnett told me on Monday to help him find an apartment, show him where he needed to live, what part of town to be in. So we went and found, you know, on the south side, put him at Villa Rouge, I think is where we put him, or Falcons, or I can't remember where we put him. Anyway, got him on the south side, told him where everything was. And I'm not sure how long he was here. It was not long. Because he got homesick and he left. That's the reason he wasn't here no longer than what he was.
Well, also, you got to think about the fact that, you know, in his home territory, he could win and he could, you know, be pushed. And once again here, it wasn't the same situation. I mean, you know, he may get pushed, but it's not going to be because his last name necessarily is Von Erich.
I'll tell you another guy that came in here that didn't last long, coming right out of that same part of the world, was Gino Hernandez.
Mm-hmm.
He came in here, and he was here a very short time. Same kind of deal. Out in Texas, he was pushed. He was put on top. He was, you know, a star out there, and he came in here, and all of a sudden he found out he was just part of the pack, and he didn't last long either.
Jerry, did you ever work with any of the Von Erichs?
I was partners with Kevin when I was in Kansas City. And you should have seen that. I never seen a man that doped up my life actually go to the ring.
Was it Kevin
it was
or Kerry?
Kevin.
That was Kevin. Who was it, Jerry, was on the show that night that told us that he took Kerry on a – wasn't it Kerry? Yeah, he was one wrestle barefooted. It was Kerry. Somebody was on the show one night and talked about him pulling on the side of the road and him going out and climbing a tree or something.
Yeah, who told us about that?
I can't. We had somebody on the show said they were making a trip somewhere out of Dallas going up toward Missouri or somewhere. And said he told the guy he's riding with to stop, and he said he got out and run out in the middle of a field and climbed a tree.
Yeah, I don't know. I cannot remember who told us that. Well, I don't doubt it.
What was the purpose of climbing the tree?
He's nuts. Robin doped up. Because the guy said he waited on him, and because I remember Jerry said I'd have drove off and left him in the tree. But I mean, he's kind of in his own world.
He and I were partners in Kansas City, right? And we was against Kabuki and somebody else. But he went to drop an elbow on Kabuki and landed in his face, his whole body. Got out the dressing room. I said, you might kill Kabuki. He said, man, that air conditioner blew me. I went ahead and got undressed, took a shower, and left. I didn't even comment. I mean, he didn't even know his name. He was serious, though.
Had he been to Colorado right before then?
Well, his name was Atkinson, but nobody did know that, you know. That's
yeah. Yeah.
And I'm surprised he lasted longer than all of them.
Yep.
I saw him in Vegas last year. He looks like he's 100 years old.
Does he really?
Yes, he does.
Wow.
The first heel time, Jesus, that's easy for me to say.
Easy
for
you to say.
Team, yeah, the first heel team I ever actually enjoyed came in here in the fall of 1980, the Freebirds. What can you guys tell me about the Freebirds?
What you want to know?
I don't know. Was life as crazy as it looked?
You'd pass them on the side of the road, and they'd be running around trying to pee on each other. They would get in the shower, and you would hear them screaming and yelling, and they'd be trying to pee on each other. They were kind of in their own little world most of the time. You know, Gordy was just a baby. I mean, he was, you know, when he was in here doing all that, you know, he wasn't but about 19 or 20 years old.
They only had one worker.
Yeah, Buddy Roberts.
He was the worker.
Yes, sir.
But he was the worker.
He could do anything he wanted to. Terry was the brawn of the outfit, and of course Michael was the mouthpiece. they were kind of in their own little world as far as them three traveling around together, but. I knocked on the door one morning in Columbus, Ohio, at the Regency, at the Hyatt Regency, and I was giving them their checks, and it was early on a Monday morning, and they opened the door, and Buddy Roberts just cracked the door, and he said, "Oh, it's you, come on in." And I said, "I wouldn't come in there if y'all was giving away money." I just handed him in envelopes and walked off. But, you know, Buddy Roberts was, I mean, he was just, Buddy was phenomenal.
Well, I remember him, you know, originally with his run with All South with as the Hollywood Blondes.
Jerry Brown, yeah, him
yep,
and Jerry Brown.
And they were an excellent team.
Yes, yes. And they left us, went to Florida, and then wound up back here working for the NWA office for a while. Buddy broke in as Dale Valentine.
Yep.
And Ronnie Garvin told me the story when he first came into Oklahoma, when he first started, he said they told him that, they said, "Now, you got to be careful with Terry." He said, "Terry wears this ring," and he said, "He'll try to flick it in your face." And said, "What he does, he hypnotizes you." And said, "You know, the stories about Terry are true. He'll take advantage of you once he hypnotizes you." So they had Buddy Roberts scared that every time Terry would get close to him, he'd run. So they set the deal up where they had to make a trip with them, him and Ronnie, and they had to spend the night somewhere, and they all was in the same room, and Buddy was so scared of Terry, he slept in the bathtub with the door locked. But that's Ronnie Garvin told me that story. But, yeah, he was just he was a phenomenal worker. And, of course, you know, Michael started down in the Mobile territory. He was from Pensacola, Mobile, down in that area, and him and Bill Moody or Percy Pringle or Paul Bear, whatever you know him by, they used to make trips together. They started at the same time. They were best friends. And Terry from North Georgia, his uncle was a promoter running little outlaw shows up there. And that's how Terry got started. I've actually seen I've got a piece of footage here somewhere, I'd have to find it, of Terry Gordy wrestling under a mask as Mr. Wrestling when he was 14. He was working for Lou Thesz when he was promoting up in Nashville in opposition to Nick Gulas.
I just came across a name and remembered a story, and I want to ask you guys if you can shed any light on it, confirm it, debunk it, whatever. Austin Idol. I remember a story where he apparently won some kind of battle royal. I don't know if it was Columbus or Macon, but it was for Fred Ward. And apparently the word is he actually took a check that he wasn't supposed to take for winning the battle royal that he was presented in the ring and cashed it.
The next morning, he went to the bank and cashed it.
That's a true story.
That is.
$10,000.
Right. $10,000.
Yes, sir. He took it into a bank.
How'd that
go over? He spent the night, and Jerry, I think Jerry can confirm this, he took it into a bank, and the bank manager was at the matches and said, oh, yeah, he won it. I saw him win it last night, and they cashed it.
Well, think about it. How was the check made out? I mean, you know, if it
didn't
was made
have
out
a,
to...
It said winner of Battle Royal.
Okay. I mean, you know, walk in with something that says Austin Idol on it, and what are you going to pull out to identify yourself? You better be somebody that the bank manager had seen.
The bank manager was at the matches. He said, I know him. He won it. I seen him win it last night. And, you know, the funny part about it is you know, I wrote I probably wrote 1,000 of those checks over the years for battle royals at different places. But when it got down to the signature, I would sign Donald Duck, Mickey Mouse, Baby Huey. You know, I'd put something. I never signed them. Fred signed the check. And I guess, you know, I mean.
Well, that's what they get for letting Austin Idol win a battle royal. Should have worked for him.
So how did it play out after the fact?
He was given an option of being fired or giving the money back, or I forget what they told him, but it wasn't pleasant, and he gave the money back.
It shows you what kind of person he is. I'm just telling you. I know him.
Yeah, I here again, this is my opinion. I don't know. I never wrestled him, but I didn't think he was that good a worker myself.
Well, you should have tried it. I had trouble with him out in Oregon.
You know, you got to give the guy credit for going through the very traumatic accident that he went through in his original persona and doing whatever it took to come back into the business. You know, it was quite a transformation from Mike McCord to Austin Idol.
I didn't know who he was first time I saw him.
I was, you know, I saw him and I said, Charlie McGowan said, you know who that is? I said, well, you know, he's kind of doing a Ric Flair impersonation. I don't know. He said, that's Mike McCord. And I said, you're kidding me. But you had to really look at him hard in the face, because I remember when McCord came, you know, when he came back after the accident and did a few shots at the auditorium, and his, you know, his feet were just, the heels were just gone.
Yeah.
And the only way he could work or eventually become who he was to lose that great deal of weight, because he could, you know, he couldn't physically support himself weighing what he weighed. But he, you know, he did come back, and to be able to do that, you know, I had to give the guy credit for that, and he developed a totally different persona. And I think, you know, most guys in wrestling under the hoods or whatever, eventually people will figure out who they are. But I think for a long, long time, a lot of people never caught on that Mike McCord and Austin Idol were the same guy.
No. What kind of trouble did you have with him in Oregon, Jerry?
Do what, Bobby?
What kind of trouble did you have with him in Oregon?
I was working with him somewhere up in Washington, and he was telling me every move to make. And I told him, I said, Mike, I think more about this than you'll ever learn. I said, you just keep your mouth shut, all right? He never said another word. Like he said about Hogan, he didn't know a padlock from a hammerlock. You know, and he looked good. I give him credit. I give him all the credit in the world, you know. But he did some other stuff besides the $10,000 check that wasn't. That was just him, you know.
I hear he's selling real estate down in Florida. Can you imagine buying a house from him?
No, sir.
No.
No, sir.
Swampland in Florida.
Yeah. Got this beautiful little spot overlooking the Everglades.
Yes. He's probably sold people quicksand and everything else. That's who he is.
All right. Before we get out of here tonight, I want to ask you guys each the same question, because all of you grew up here. All of you watched wrestling and Some of you worked here longer than others, but you were all here for a considerable amount of time. So even before you guys got in the business and all the way to the end of GCW, let's say. Best wrestler. Best overall performer. Bobby.
Oh, geez. Hard to say best overall because there's a lot of them could fit that category. Tag team, no offense to the Oates brothers, but I think Tom and Jody were probably the best team I ever saw. Individual performer, actual wrestler, God, Funk Jr., Briscoe, God, I don't know if I can narrow it down to one. I'd probably say Funk Jr. and Briscoe were probably at the top of the list or pretty close.
All right. Jerry.
Well, I agree with Bobby on everybody he said except for the state of Georgia, for the long haul and the people believed in, that would be two.
Yeah.
That would, for me, you know. Even
yeah.
from when I was a kid till I wound up doing it, you know. The people just believed in him. And he was a good man. He was nothing but always kind to me. He was
yep.
very, very kind to me. And that's characters had a lot to do with it, too, you know. But I would have to say him, Rich.
If you ever took one of the knee lifts, you believed in him, too.
Well, I took one. That's why I'm saying that, sir.
All right, and since Bobby gave me a tag team, Jerry.
Assassins.
All right. Jay?
Well, yeah, the Assassins were great wrestling one and two when they worked together. But I'll tell you, going back, Ray Gunkel and Buddy Fuller, you know, they drew. And they were fan favorites when I first started watching. You know, really got interested in wrestling, and you know, it's you can think about the big time of Georgia Championship Wrestling, but Atlanta Live Wrestling. It was people wanted to see Ray Gunkel and Buddy Fuller.
All right, I'm going to give you each three options on the question. You can only give me one. Bobby, best announcer, Gordon Solie, Ed Capral, Jim Carlisle.
Totally.
Jay?
Well, you know, I liked them all, and they all had their, you know, what they had. But there was nobody like Gordon. He's definitely
Jerry?
It.
All right, Jerry?
There was Gordon Solie, and then there was the rest.
Yep.
Without a doubt.
All right. And, oh, let's see. I don't know how to phrase this. I'll go ahead and say most memorable angle that you can remember in forever, going all the way back as far as you can, all the way to the end in 84. Bobby?
I guess the one that I was involved in has probably caused the most stir was when the Freebirds dropped DiBiase on his head on TV.
That was a thing of beauty. And go ahead and elaborate on that too, just because yeah, I've heard you tell the story, obviously, but some of our listeners may not have.
The deal was, we talked about it. We talked about it on Friday in the office. What we were going to do. My part of the plan was that I was at the TV station that morning, which was not unusual. I went to the TV station anyway, most Saturday mornings. I was there. As soon as they dropped him on his head on the floor, I called 911 to get an ambulance en route to the TV station. The deal was they were supposed to keep rolling film the whole entire time, so we had all of this documented. About 2 minutes into the scenario, I realized that the tape had stopped. So I ran to the control room, and I told the director, who I – it was either Skip Ellison or Greg Gunn. I can't remember. I think it was Skip Ellison. I ran to the dressing to the control room, and I said, Skip, start that tape back up. I said, this happened outside the ring. I said, this could involve a lawsuit involving the TV station, us, and everybody else. I said, we need this documented. Roll that tape. So he bought it, and he started rolling the tape. And after the tape was rolling, of course, the ambulance showed up, and we hauled him out of there, and we took him over to Crawford Long Hospital here in Atlanta. And it just so happened that Dr. Michael Politsas, who was the physician we paid to come to the auditorium on Friday nights, was on call in the emergency room. And I convinced him he was going to let him go. He said, I can't find anything wrong other than he's complaining his neck's hurting. And I convinced him that, because it happened outside the ring and we might be looking at a lawsuit or whatever, I said, can we admit him for observation for 48 hours? I said, don't worry about the bills. I said, Georgia Championship will pay the bills. I said, we just need to make sure he's okay. We just got to protect ourselves. And he goes, well, he said, I can justify that. He said, because we probably do need to look at him. So we admitted him to the hospital. In a matter of about 12 hours, they had to shut the switchboard down at Crawford Long Hospital because so many people were calling. We had to put him in a room and list him under another name so that the fans couldn't find him. And we kept him there for 2 days, and that's pretty much how it went down. And then, of course, we worked the matches with him for the next 2 months. So, but that's how that deal went down.
I remember watching that as it happened, and that's probably the one time where I literally, once I'd kind of already started questioning whether or not what I was seeing was actually happening, and that was one of those where you go, really? No wonder. that played out like a thing of beauty. Jerry, most memorable angle for you.
Well, I was working for the Georgia office, and Buckle was running, and it was happening in Columbus. I don't know why I was off that night, and I went to the match. Kathy and I sat way up on the top, and people saw me sitting up there, but I didn't care. When Tom worked with Jody, and it sticks out of my memory, you know, because I remember seeing them in Columbus when I was in high school, you know, and that was just intriguing to me the way they did that.
Jay?
Bobby, you remember that?
Oh, go ahead.
You talking about the angle between Tom and Jody when we did the deal where they were both unmasked?
Yeah.
Without the mask, yeah. I was going to say, I got a program back here you may like a copy of. I actually have a program with them on the cover with their assassin outfits on without the mask.
Well, when Tom Ernesto unmasked on television right there standing next to Ed Capel, I think that was one of the biggest shocks fans, you know, that didn't know anything that was going on behind the scenes. I think that probably was one of the biggest jaw droppers in the history of the television show.
It had to have been. It had to have been.
You know, I was standing about 2 foot behind the camera when he did that. I was putting up the TV ring and running errands at the time. I was probably 14, 15. I might have been 16. I don't know. But it was Capel didn't, you know, nobody, the only person that knew he was going to do that was Jody Hamilton. And Jody was in Japan. And I didn't even know Jody knew it until he told me the story years later.
Ed Capel was pretty deadpan, but you could see from the look on his face that he was just, you know, it was real. He was totally shocked.
Yeah, he had no clue. Nobody knew he was going to do it except Tom and Jody. And he had called Jody in Japan the day before and told him he was going to do it and the reasons he was going to do it. And of course, that was all leading up to the split. Of course, nobody knew at the time, but it was a pretty intense moment when that happened.
And you know, as Jerry was saying, as far as something that you know I really enjoyed strictly as a fan was towards the end of the All South run when Tom Renesto came out of retirement and came back into the ring with Jody.
Yeah, that was pretty much the end of it for them too, right?
Yeah, I don't know if Bobby, you're the guy who would know, but I think it was really, you know, in my opinion, a lot of folks just thought he was, you know, it was kind of a last straw to save the thing from going under.
It's like you had said about the talent. We had exhausted. You know, I mean, I don't know what his reasonings were for the bookings and the way he did the things he did, but you know, we had everywhere he tried to get talent, you know, we were getting blocked. So it could very well have been, but that was an interesting time. I mean, I look back on that and I am so thankful that I got to be in the ring with those guys. You know, because when I first started with Gunkel, you know, of course, Tom wasn't working, and I never got to work with the team of the Assassins until they did that deal, and it was that was a fun time.
One of the best matches I ever saw was the Assassins against the Terry Funk and Senior. I mean, that was, you know, there were no holes in that match. It was strictly just, as Gordon would call it, a Pier 6 brawl. And that was one of the best shows I ever saw, that match.
All right. Guys, good show tonight. Any last thoughts before we wrap it up?
Nope, I'm just glad to be back on the air.
Yeah, me too.
Bobby, you take care of yourself. You hear me?
I'm going to do my best, sir.
I've been back to work.
I've been off since before Christmas, and I'm going back to work Monday, so I think that's going to be good for me. And
it will.
Get my mind on some other stuff.
Best to you, Bobby, and good to hear you. Good to hear you. You sound good. And, you know, once again, a lot of folks are thinking about you.
I appreciate it very much, guys.
All right, guys. Good show tonight. Let's try it again next week.
Sounds good.
We'll do it, guys.
All right.
Good night, guys.
All right. That's it for us this week. Be sure to stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Thanks a lot.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.